Hey everyone, and welcome to Between the Creations. My name is Lauren Hook, and each week on the podcast, I and my guest discuss various aspects of theology, Christianity, and the Bible. I'm so glad you've decided to join us. Let's get started. Thanks for joining me this week. It's a huge help when you like, rate, and subscribe to Between the Creations wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also follow the podcast on Instagram or Facebook for news about upcoming episodes. You can find out more about the podcast, submit topics you'd like me to cover on an episode, or even ask me to speak at your event at laurianhook.com. Welcome, everyone, to this week's episode of Between the Creations. It's so good to have you with us. I'm excited to introduce you to this week's guest. He has written several books and is on Twitter, and that's kind of where I found his work initially, in that weird kind of 21st century social media way. But I'm really pleased to introduce you all to Dr. Andrew Abernethy. He is over at Wheaton and does stuff with Old Testament. So he's an associate professor of Old Testament. He's also the coordinator of the MA in Biblical Exegesis program at Wheaton. And Wheaton is just, you guys produce such great scholars. He has a Doctor of Philosophy in Theological Studies from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and a bunch of other degrees, and has written lots of books, one of which we're going to talk about today. But welcome, Andy, and do you have anything else you want to add so the listeners can get to know you better?
Hey, it's great to be on with you. Let's see here. Here in Wheaton, it's been snowing like almost every day, so I'm becoming a master of using a snowblower.
Nice.
And I'm sure you don't have that down in Texas, right?
Not right now, but the moment we're recording this, we are heading into like our winter weekend. We usually get one a year where we get all of winter in about 5 days. And so parts of Texas have snow, but not where I'm at. But yeah, it's cold.
That's great. Yeah. I also love sports. I love basketball. And I'm busy when I'm not at work with my I have three little ones. I have a two-year-old little guy and a daughter who's six and a daughter who's almost nine. So
awesome.
My wife and I are having in a really kind of fun phase of life.
Yeah, and not busy at all, I'm sure, with any of that.
No, not busy, but I tell you, it strikes me during COVID, I really appreciate the busyness, you know, when you get home because you feel less isolated. My heart goes out to those who don't have as much stimulation.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Throughout the day. So yeah, we're staying busy though, that's for sure.
Good, good, good. Well, today we're going to talk about your book that you co-authored, but it's God's Messiah in the Old Testament, Expectations of a Coming King. And like I said in the intro, I found this just via Twitter, honestly, because I follow you and some other people. And I think this book came up, and I'm an Old Testament person at heart. I love the Old Testament, but I also love helping people understand the Old Testament in light of the New and vice versa. And so I was like, oh, this book sounds great. And so I read it and loved it. And so we're going to talk about it. And hopefully hopefully my listeners can glean some information from it that'll help them as they read the scriptures and as they consider the work and the person of Jesus and what God's mission is in the world. So kind of as an introductory thing, one of the things that really struck me about your book is that you do a really purposeful job of explaining, hey, our goal is to talk about the royal messianic implications, because there are other types of prophecies in the Old Testament, some that God's going to send a great prophet, some that God's, you know, going to send a great type of priestly figure, but you really focus on the royal aspects of that. Could you explain that a little bit more for people who might not understand exactly the differences and kind of where that's coming from?
Yeah, that's a great question, Lorian. There's no like perfect answer to what constitutes the Messiah in the Old Testament. Like if you do a word study on Messiah, or in Hebrew, Mashiach, you're not going to get a lot of like clear answers on who the Messiah is. You know, for instance, Cyrus, a Persian king, is called a Messiah or a Mashiach, an anointed one. And so scholars and folks have to kind of figure out, okay, what are you talking about when you use the term Messiah? And I think what happens a lot of times, especially most of us are who come to the Old Testament as Christians, have in mind that like everything about Jesus is messianic. So therefore, because Jesus is the Messiah, everything in the Old Testament that might point to him becomes messianic. That's what I'd kind of refer to as like the broad view of messianic. So like if you're reading about the tabernacle or the priestly or the sacrificial system, you're like, okay, this is messianic because it's anticipating how God will use a sacrifice, let's say in the future. Or the temple all of a sudden is viewed as messianic because Jesus is the temple of God. Or as you were talking about, you know, if you think of Isaiah, the suffering servant figure, you know, who at least in my reading, there's some who will interpret it like it's talking about a king, but I tend to view it as more talking about a suffering kind of priestly figure whose blood kind of brings about restoration. You know, so this idea of messianic, you have to define what you're talking about. And if you take the broad view, pretty much a book like the one Greg and I wrote would all of a sudden need to be a commentary on the entire Old Testament.
Right.
Where yes. Like everything that talks about God because Jesus is the Son of God all of a sudden is fair game for how it's preparing for Jesus. So what we did was we decided, all right, we're not going to try to do everything in this book. Because sometimes if you try to do everything, you accomplish nothing.
Exactly.
We've tried to focus in, all right, where are those points where you get a sense for the way that a king is fitting into God's plan and will play a role in God's future plan. So kings were often anointed. That's where the term Messiah comes from. In Hebrew, it's Mashach is the verb and Mashiach is the noun. And this term Messiah kind of connects to kings pretty frequently. If you did a study on the word anointed or the anointed one, it's often going to relate to kings, even if it can apply to priests and prophets as well. So we decided to just kind of focus mainly on that royal side of messianic expectations. So we take a more narrow view in the book, but we're not opposed to recognizing that there could be other messianic strands.
Exactly. Yeah.
And
so
yeah.
That one of the things that I have, you know, As I've studied, as I've learned and grown, you know, in the past decade or so, oftentimes when I was growing up, I grew up in the church. I grew up in, you know, private education even. So we talked a lot about things like the servant songs of Isaiah, things like these other, what we would say were prophetic, messianic, you know, utterances about God's coming ruler. And one of the things that has been really, really helpful for me, you know, again, in the past decade, you know, relearning some things, but, and you guys pointed out in the book, is that the messianic figure, this kind of royal Davidic king, was one aspect of many of how God was going to restore and reign and rule. There was also this prophetic, this priestly office that needed to be taken care of. It was the kings and the priests together that were supposed to kind of rule and reign and help Israel fulfill its duty. And so we oftentimes, at least me, when I was growing up, I thought, well, yeah, Jesus does all of those things. He fulfills both. He's the priest and the king and even the prophet and all of these things. But that wasn't exactly what they were expecting. They were not expecting, in many ways, this to be one office or one person in whatever we call the Messiah. They were thinking, oh, there's going to be a king, and then there's going to be a priest, and there's going to be prophets. They're not all going to be one person. Could you kind of elaborate on that or comment on that a little bit? Because I think that's helpful in how we then read the New Testament's understanding of Jesus.
Yeah, I think that you raise a great point of, yeah, like when you see the Old Testament unfolding, the original authors didn't know how all the dots were going to connect in one person, which is just unbelievable. So like if you read Zechariah, for instance, in Zechariah, you see he's like talking about a branch from the line of David who will come. And then he's also talking about a priest from the line of Joshua that's going to come. You see in the Psalms, sometimes they'll talk about a priest from the line of Melchizedek, which is a whole different priestly line. And you'll see this like a coming messenger who kind of connects to John the Baptist in the New Testament in Malachi. So you see this kind of range of expectations of how God is going to be using these different offices. But what we don't have is how this will all take place. And I'd add one other big one too, other than like prophet, priest, and king, that's the real a big shocker, is all these promises that God is going to come.
Yes.
You know, like that's the kind of core hope in Israel's scriptures is that God is going to come and do something. And we don't know, I mean, is it going to be like when God came at Mount Sinai in this major cloud, unmediated kind of, and what we see is that somehow in Jesus, this like expectations that God is going to come, this expectation of a coming king, this expectation of a prophet, this expectation of priestly figure, all this whole realm of expectations kind of find their meeting place in him. And it's really just, on the one hand, like I was leading one a neighborhood Bible study, right? And we're reading some of the Gospels, and a lady who hadn't been in church for about 40 years or so came to this, which was so awesome. And I'm just like, so like, what does this like tell you about God? And she's like, that God is really complex, you know, like, and she said it with real sincerity that like, wow, God's plan is more rich. So there's this complexity to it, but there's also this wonder, you know, that comes out of that of like, oh God, you are far greater, far wiser, far more incredible than anything we can even imagine. So, yeah. So you're exactly right. How these strands come together is a bit unexpected.
Absolutely, yeah. And we lose a lot when we think that, like, when we read the New Testament just from our, you know, lens of being able to look back, and we're like, yeah, of course this all makes sense. And I think we lose some of the wonder. And when we're reading these New Testament authors processing, you know, who Jesus is and how is Jesus saving and how is God through Jesus doing things? I think we gain a lot of wonder back when we are able to read this and realize they were kind of figuring some of this out along the way. Like this was not what they thought was going to happen in the truest sense of the word. They had other ideas. And then this blew their minds that God did all of this through one person and that it was actually God doing all of it at once. Like it's incredible to think.
it really is. It's wonderful, in fact. And especially when you see a delay in the fulfillment of these, you know, there wasn't a Davidic king and on the throne for 580 something years. And you're wondering what's happened to this promise and that promise. Then like, boom, fireworks it's like the, you know, amazing finale, right? Where it all comes together in Christ. So
yeah, exactly. Exactly. So if I can, I want to point to something from the book specifically. It kind of starts, just so you know, kind of on page 56 and 57, you're talking about 1st and 2nd Samuel and how we see Davidic kingship portrayed in 1st and 2nd Samuel and the hope of a fulfilled kind of ultimate Davidic kingship. And you lay out these ways that the king is going to reign and rule, and how we know who the true and right king is and how we distinguish a good king from a bad king in some ways. And there's four ways that you guys lay out. One, the first one is the king will have a heart after God's heart. The second is a king that is centered on God's kingship. So he's representing God's kingship on earth. Three is a king who implements justice. And then the last one is a king victorious in battle for Israel. And I love that this type of messianic kingly figure that you broke it down this way. And I, because for me at least, the justice one seems kind of obvious. Like, yeah, we would hope that God's king would work towards justice. But this idea of a king centered on God's kingship, which again, in Jesus, we kind of get this weird, like, oh, it is God. But could you maybe comment on the four of those and how Israel's expectations were both hopeful but also crushed time after time after time through their bad kings, through exile, and through all of the things that they endured, the wave after wave of unmet expectations.
Yeah. Happy to comment on that. You know, what's happening when David becomes king, we have to see it in the backdrop of the first king of Israel, who is Saul. Sometimes my students will say, well, why did God choose Saul? Why didn't he just, like, start with David? I think it's because God knew that Saul would provide a nice, like, foil to, here's what I don't want in a king. And when the kingship started out, Samuel said, all right, things will be well for you, O Israel, if you and your king obey me. But if they don't, it won't go well. That's in 1 Samuel 12. And right after 1 Samuel 12, what do we find out about Saul? He disobeys God by offering sacrifice before Samuel comes. And the statement that God says to Saul through Samuel, I think, gives us a clue into what God really wants in a king. He says this in 1 Samuel 13. Let me get there. In verse 13 of chapter 13, it says, you've done foolishly. You've not kept the command of your God, which he commanded you, for then the Lord would have established your kingdom forever. But now your kingdom will not continue. And the Lord has sought out a man after his own heart. And the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people. What God seems most concerned about is the heart of the king. And he wants that heart to correspond to God's heart. And you see that in chapter 16, when Samuel's picking out the next king, he thinks it's going to be the first king, the oldest one. And God's like, I don't look on outward appearance. I look according to the heart. There's that heart thing again. And so what you see portrayed in David, David is by far not perfect. He blows it with Bathsheba. He has Uriah killed. But the impression you get when you read from 1 Samuel 16 all the way up to 2 Samuel 10 is the good side of David. And what that good side of David gives you is a window into a heart that loves the Lord. You see him praying. You see him seeking God. You see him not laying his hand on Saul. You see him living a heart after God's own heart. You see this reflected in the Psalms. And you see this, and the first thing he does right after he becomes king, and this comes to the second aspect of what a king should be like, is going to center upon God's presence as king. The first thing David does after he becomes king is he takes over Jerusalem and wants to bring God's throne there, the Ark of the Covenant. And this is just showing that the Davidic king's heart, in its best and truest like manifestation, is going to recognize that God's kingship is at the core of what his life and what his kingdom will be all about. And so we bring the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, and this is an incredible moment, right, of acknowledging that God is really king of this kingdom. And you see that reflected in David's heart. But as you mentioned, I mean, there's also the justice and righteousness aspect. If God is a king of justice and righteousness, we're told positively of how David brings about justice and righteousness across Israel. And this is the idea of social justice, making sure the most vulnerable in society are experiencing fair treatment in his kingdom, which is a manifestation of what God wants his kingdom to be like. So so in David, yeah, these ideals of a king whose heart is just aligning with God and seeking God. Second aspect, a king who wants to center reality around God's kingship and ultimately the temple, and then this commitment to bringing justice and righteousness in society are huge. And you also see this king bringing peace, being a means God uses to bring peace to God's people in Israel. So these seem to be kind of like the ideal you see in David. But then what you see in David, who starts off so well, is in chapter 11, as soon as he blows it with Bathsheba and has Uriah killed, we see things begin to unravel a bit. And you see God is committed to the family line of David forever in light of his covenant promises. And you start seeing, well, David, hopefully there'll be one even better than David that will come someday, because things didn't end well. You know, it's like Family Feud, the rest of the book of Samuel. And you begin having these hopes for, wow, I wonder if there'll be a king someday who will be forever obeying God and having a heart after God's own heart, be forever committed to God's kingdom in the temple and justice and righteousness and so forth. And I guess I'll just end on this. As you move forward in the book of 1 and 2 Kings, this kind of is the litmus test. Like, all right, you don't read a ton about what these kings do, except for whether their hearts were aligning with God or not. And yeah, all of northern Israel's kings didn't obey, did evil in the sight of the Lord. Some of David's descendants did what was right. Some of them did evil, including his son Solomon. But you have this ideal that's kind of been in place that these judges are being evaluated in light of. And you're wondering, will this ideal king ever come about?
Yeah.
And you end with kings with no king. Mm-hmm. They're in exile. And you're wondering, yeah, what's going to come of these promises that
it's,
God has made?
It's the ultimate cliffhanger in a lot of ways. Like and this is something that I have to remind people when we approach the scriptures, it's telling us a story, and we read it as the people who kind of know the ending and who know that, you know, what happens next and knows the rest of the family lineage and all that stuff. But we lose some of the kind of anticipation and just the tension that we're left with questions like what you just said. Will there be even a better king than David? Because for all the good that David did and for how he did really search after the Lord in many ways, there's still so many aspects that were not ideal, that we're not just this kind of golden age of what we really, really need. And so that anticipation, I think, then gets kicked out to the prophets in many ways.
Yeah.
As we wait and as we kind of seek and wonder and ask a lot of questions and don't really get a lot of answers in some ways.
Yeah,
I think if I can point us towards another part of your book on page 136 to talk about the prophets a little bit. You're talking about Amos, but we're kind of just diving into the prophets writ large. And I love the first sentence of this chapter because it speaks so well to Christians and to myself even, who, again, we're prone. We know the story. We know what's happening. But this is such a good reminder. You guys write, it would be a mistake to read the Old Testament prophets only for predictions about the coming of Jesus. For that would be to use them in a highly selective fashion and to impose a foreign agenda on their productions. Hmm. Could you comment on that a little bit about how we read the Bible kind of backwards in some ways, and maybe we should read it forwards to help us get the story down a little bit better?
Yeah, definitely. You know, this is the beauty of having written this with a co-author. I'm going to have to channel Greg on this one.
Yeah, right.
He wrote this chapter. But of course, we read and commented on each other's work. But I think what happens, and you'll see this even with other books on Messiah in the Old Testament, they'll kind of hop around from one little promise to another. You know, so like in Amos, there's only one possibly messianic promise, it's at the very end of the book. And if all you do is jump to those verses because you just want to kind of see how they're messianic and maybe look at how they're quoted in Acts, you know, there's insight, there's things to be gained from it. But what we miss is how deeply embedded this prospect of a hope, or this restoration of David's tent, which Greg teases out really well. David built a tent, and that tent, or the tent of David, was actually the tent for the tabernacle, right, of God's kingship. And it's kind of bringing both of these aspects together. But what you get from Amos is, it's a dark book. It's not like other prophets that, like, let me give you some judgment and a little hope, some judgment and a little hope. It's like, boom, 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 all judgment for injustice in the land, for them going after other gods. And when you reach the end of the book with this vision of hope, you just get this sense that God is going to do some major cleaning of house. He has got, and he wants to create a people who are going to be pursuing justice and righteousness, people who are going to only be worshiping him. And after he brings judgment on his people, there's this grand hope that that will come, this time of restoration and this hope for a king. So I think what we miss, we miss some of that richness of hope, right, of how these promises of what God is going to be doing in the future and in his king, and how that really serves as a contrast with things are going to be different in the future than how they are now. God wants to change reality, and he's going to do it through judgment. And this is going to result in something far greater and grander, which involves hope for a Davidic king. So you're kind of anchored into this judgment of sin that somehow is going to result in something glorious through a Davidic king. And so we miss out on some of that if we only read backwards from the new into the old.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I love that you pointed out this idea of the hope that was that they had to really cling to. They had to cling to the covenant. They had to cling to the hope. Those of them who were attempting to remain faithful in some capacity, despite the chaos that was just really unfurling all around them. To kind of continue on in this vein of the prophets, so Isaiah. Which, you know, is the big one, which I know you did you spent a lot of time in Isaiah.
Yeah, I do.
Right. But I want to talk about the servant songs, because whenever people want to talk about, Good Friday, or when we want to talk about, even just the Messiah writ large, almost everyone that I know, most sermons that I've heard, all those things, they want to point back to Isaiah and specifically the servant songs, which in many, many ways, and you guys write about this in the book, they are not royal messianic psalms. There might be undertones maybe there, but they're not royal messianic psalms in the proper sense. So could you kind of elaborate on the servant songs? And because they're kind of one of those places that Christians love to like really like white knuckle and hold on to really hard. And we're like, we love these verses. But maybe we've kind of misunderstood them in some ways.
You know what? I want to white knuckle these servant songs too. I love them. I love them. And we want to make sure though that the juice we squeeze out of them is the juice that's there.
Yeah.
And I think that like the juice that you squeeze out of the servant songs bleeds priest, prophet. And just for your listeners, to maybe the servant songs idea is kind of newer to them. What Lorien is referring to is there in the first half of Isaiah, there are four promises about a coming king. It will refer to them reigning and bringing justice and righteousness. You'll see that in Isaiah 9, Isaiah 11, Isaiah 16, and Isaiah 32. But when you get to the second half of the book, the context now has shifted to what is transpiring in exile. And the question now is, how can Israel and the nations be set right with God when God has brought such judgment on his people? It's a different question. It's not so much about a reigning king. And so you don't get promises about a coming Davidic king who's going to rule and reign with justice and righteousness like you see earlier in the book. Instead, you get these four songs kind of mingled into Isaiah 40 to 55. You see the first one in Isaiah 42, the second one in Isaiah 49, the third one in Isaiah 50, and the last one at the end of chapter 52 into chapter 53. And these songs refer to a servant, okay? And I could spend a whole podcast on these
right.
servant songs. They're so beautiful. But what I think we miss if we kind of read these as if they're talking about a coming Davidic king is we might miss out on what's really different about these promises than what was earlier in the book. And the biggest difference I see is there's an extreme focus on how this servant is going to bring people back to God. It's more of a reconciliation sort of role. So for instance, I'm going to just read a passage in Isaiah 49 where he talks about how this servant, God, the servant is saying that God has chosen him, polished him like an arrow for this special purpose. And here's what God says to him. He says, "It is too light of a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to bring back the preserved of Israel. I will make you as a light for the nations that my salvation may reach the end of the ends of the earth." So what God's saying here is, listen, O servant, you've envisioned your task as being to bring Israel back to God, like a prophet saying, come back to God, come back to God, come back to God. But he says, I've also make you a light for the nations. So somehow this priestly prophetic servant is going to be calling Israel and calling the nations back to God himself. But the question is, how in the world can that take place?
Yeah.
Right? How does a servant do that? Is it through coming as a mighty king and establishing his throne and ruling and reigning in justice? Well, at some point, that's what Jesus is going to do. But here, there's something that needs to happen first. This reconciliation back to God is going to happen in a really surprising way. And you see this spelled out in Isaiah 52, verses 13 to 53, 12, where you see it's actually the surprising work through a suffering servant who people considered like stricken by God, they considered
right.
God forsaken, and then all of a sudden they're like, oh, what? His wounds are what healed me. His chastisement is what has brought us peace. We all like sheep had gone astray. We'd all turned to our own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. So this focus of the suffering servant seems to just be part of God's amazing plan of enabling Israel and all nations to be brought back to God through this atoning suffering of a servant. And so I would just say to our listeners, keep white knuckling this passage, but remember, you're getting some really special juice here. This is not just talking about a coming king. This is talking about a prophetic priestly figure who is going to be restoring the world, reconciling the world back to God. And this is one of those passages that you, if you read scholars, and Lorraine, I'm sure you've come across this, scholar, we don't know what to do with this passage in terms of how it would have been originally understood.
Yeah, but, yeah.
You know, like, who's talking about a human being being a sacrifice in the Old Testament?
Yeah, they're not real keen on that in Israel. They're like, yeah. God told us about that. We were warned against that. We're not going to, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, for the kings are going to be amazed at this too, you know?
Yeah.
It's just this amazing passage. And I think that God in his providence offered this prophecy in a way that would be partly understood initially, but then when Jesus comes and dies on the cross and suffers for sin and raises again, eyes begin opening, and you see, even like the Ethiopian eunuch on the road reading Isaiah 53, I think, is it Philip or Peter who comes alongside and begins with that and tells him the good news about Jesus.
So. Yeah, the whole story. And I mean, and I even think back to Jesus explaining, I mean, all the law and the prophets to these two travelers that he's with after his resurrection, right? And they don't realize what's happening. I think part of the reason, at least this is how I like to imagine it, part of the reason they maybe didn't realize what was happening was because their tradition for generations and centuries was built on this idea that there would be a king, and then there would be priests, and then there would be prophets, and those would not be the same person.
Yeah.
And so to have this all explained and then culminating in one person, and that person being divine, was just madness to them. And so, of course, they're going to miss it. And we like to be like, how could you be standing right next to the risen Lord and him tell you all of the whole story and you miss it? And it's like, well, I think part of it is, let's cut him some slack. Part of it is probably because the way they had been told the story for generations was that God was going to do something. Yeah. God would restore. But it wasn't going to be through one person who was holding all of those offices in tandem.
Yeah, they didn't know that. And you even see the scene where, like, Jesus says to his disciples, okay, who do you say that I am? Then Peter gets an A+. It's like, you are the Messiah. Jesus is like, oh, that's only been revealed to you by God. Then it says that, and then Jesus talked about how he's going to be going to Jerusalem and suffering and die. And then Peter pulls him aside and rebukes Jesus, like, hey, wait a minute. That's not what I imagined that the Messiah that I just said you were is going to be doing, right?
Yeah, you haven't been reading the same scrolls that I've been reading. Let's get on the same page here.
Yeah. And so it's interesting, how there are certain strands that were, like, really going to be connected in the early Jewish kind of imagination with the Messiah. But then God's like, whoa, there's so much I'm bringing together in Jesus. It's going to take time. And thankfully, Jesus has provided good instruction, and we have the Spirit now and the scriptures. But and thankfully, God was patient with Peter too, right? So he even after denying him three times, even later in the story, Jesus nevertheless uses him then as a mouthpiece that declares in Acts 2 how all these different strands of scripture, Joel 2,
right?
You know, the Psalms and all this is coming together in Jesus, and it's just so cool.
Yeah, I feel like Peter in Acts 2, and then later when Stephen's great testimony that Stephen offers, is both of those are just this incredible synthesis given to them by the Spirit, where they are able to in some way culminate everything in Jesus, which of course that's what we're all doing, right? But for them to do it so close to everything actually happening, and for them to do it so close to, you know, all of these things being witnessed, you know, right before their eyes, is really incredible to me. Because again, like you said, Peter is the one who was like, no, that's not the way this Messiah figure operates. Let me refresh your memory. Yeah. Let's go back to the Torah. Let's go back to the prophets. Let's reread this together. And I mean, even I think, even we read the story of when you know, Jesus isn't welcomed in this town, and the disciples, you know, even I think John is one of them. They're like, "Do you want us to call down fire on them?" And Jesus is like, "No, no, no." And then you see John turn around and write these beautiful words about, you know, just things are being reconciled in their minds.
Yes.
And I think we miss some of that when we read it just backwards. And it is hard, of course, for us to divorce in our minds what we know to be true and how we know the story ends. But I think it's so beautiful when we read it the other direction.
It is. Or think about Paul. Paul knew every passage in Scripture. There is no passage of Scripture an apostle could throw at him and say, "Oh, I bet you haven't thought about this one." You know, Paul knew all of the Scriptures, but he wasn't connecting them in a particular way at first. So that's why he was killing all the Christians. He didn't like what they're saying, you know?
Right.
About this Jesus. And then he encounters him on the road to Damascus. And all of a sudden, you just see it bleeding throughout Paul's letters. And I think when it says the scales fell off his eyes, it maybe was literal that he was really blind, but it's also symbolic of how now he can see and is able to kind of recognize the richness of how all this tapestry of the early of the Scriptures of Israel can really truly be said to be pointing to this Jesus of Nazareth. So
it's so beautiful. Okay, so one last question by way of closing. I try to ask this of my Bible scholars when I have them on the podcast. And this is not specific to the book or anything, so feel free to answer it in whichever way you want to take it.
Yeah.
I like to ask you all, if you could communicate one to three key things about how we read the Scriptures back to just lay level, normal people who don't have PhDs, who aren't in the university. And if you could think of one to maybe three things where you're like, if we could grasp this a little bit better, or if we could be a little bit more clear when we talk about these topics, or here's a common mistake I see a lot of people making when we approach the Scriptures. What would those things be? Do you have something that you are always kind of trying to hammer down with your students that you see often?
Yeah, Lori, and I think that's a great, great question. The number one thing that I would just recommend for your listeners and for lay people, and even for those of us who can move away from it, is learning to read passages for their flow of thought. I think sometimes we have like a Ouija board approach to when we're reading the Bible, like, let me just kind of hover over this text and then boom, something's going to pop out. And that's what all of a sudden what God wants to kind of reveal to you. And for some reason, we read for flow of thought when we read novels, we read for flow of thought for everything else. But for some reason, when we read the Bible, we turn that part off. And I think if you could start learning, like, how is this passage flowing to actually communicate something, you're going to be drawn into what the passage as a whole is saying about God and how it's kind of wanting to speak into your life. So that would be one tip for the lay people, is, and even for maybe pastors listening, invite your people into the flow of thought. God inspired that. Okay. He didn't just give little random nuggets. Okay. He gave flows of thought that you can then draw some of those nuggets out of. But for maybe the other half of your listeners, one thing that I've had to learn is sometimes I feel like, okay, I've just done my exegetical training. I've listened carefully to it in its original context. And then I've also done some canonical reflection and some biblical theology. And it's a wonderful intellectual exercise. But what I've begun to do really just in the last year is recognize I now need to pause, go back over things, and let it draw me to what is this saying about God, and let me pray to this God who's being revealed. Let me worship this God, because sometimes you get locked in a little vacuum where it's almost like God only exists in the realm of my thoughts about the Bible. No, the Bible is pointing us to a God who is outside of the Bible, who's active in our world today, active in our lives, who's worthy of worship and prayer. So I would just throw in that meditation bit at the end of your hard work and just see how that changes your walk with God and how you carry out your vocation as a scholar and teacher. So,
yeah. Well, thank you so much for those. Those are great tips and very applicable for sure. I think for all of us. So thank you. Thank you for that. And thank you, Andy, so much for your time and just your wisdom that you shared. It was so good to meet you and have this conversation. So thank you for all of that and for your time. I will put Andy's, you know, Twitter handle and all that stuff in the show notes for you guys. I'll link to the book on Amazon. So if you guys are interested, you could grab it there. Thank you so much again for your time and your wisdom. It was so good to talk to you and meet you. Everyone, make sure if you have not already, go ahead and subscribe to the podcast, share it, like it, leave a review. That's another way that is really, really helpful for us to get the word out. So I'm always thankful for you listeners, and hang in there in the midst of, again, the pandemic or maybe some cold weather like Andy mentioned at the beginning. And we'll be back next week with another episode.